Please be advised that the subject matter discussed in this episode may be upsetting to some listeners. Topics such as murder, rape, suicide, and home invasion will be discussed.
Because we live in a Puritan police state, we are obliged to inform you that we may sometimes use explicit language. Now that you've been informed, things are about to get weird.
Welcome to What I Had Heard Was. I am Jennifer.
And I'm Anna.
And today we are talking about true crime.
Very excited about this. I'm not exactly as well-versed on this topic as you are, so I'm going to be a sponge, and I'm going to absorb all this knowledge, and I will be the Dr. Watson to your Sherlock Holmes. Actually, I feel like our guest, Miss Diane Feller, is a little more in line to be Dr. Watson or Sherlock Holmes to you in this. I would just be like the housemaid.
Hi, Diane.
Hi. I'm so excited to be here.
We are so excited to have you.
I think maybe... Is there a third partner of the Sherlock Holmes Watson team? I can't think. They have the brother.
Oh my gosh.
Who's the brother?
Oh, Mycroft.
You could be Mycroft.
Yeah, Mycroft. Mycroft, yeah.
I could just sit here and be condescending. I can do that. That's what he does, right?
Yeah, he's a little uptight.
Yeah.
You're not uptight.
Benedict Cumberbatch is the best Sherlock.
Oh my God, it's so good.
Yeah.
I mean, this gets us right into the true crime thing. It's like, it's not really true, but it's still crime. And I'll watch that shit all day long.
Oh yeah.
Well, I have to say, I actually went to whatever the address Bleecker Street is in London.
You did?
They have a museum at that address in that townhouse. And so they have recreated all the rooms, and they look exactly like the Cumberbatch. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's that room kind of a thing. But they have them all decked out in Victorian time period stuff. I was walking through it, and I had a moment where I had to, like, grab the person I was with and was like, wait a minute, Sherlock Holmes wasn't real, right? Because they had all these artifacts and these things that are like, oh, and this was the pipe that he used in this blah, blah, blah. And this was the thing. And I was like, I had to guess, he's not real, right?
Glad I'm not the only one who has those moments.
So if you're in London and you have a chance, go see the museum. It's fantastic. It's so realistic. You will think that he is a real person.
The thing is, everybody thinks Sherlock is such a dick. And really, can you imagine being that overloaded with information all the time? Like, noticing every single thing?
Yeah, I would not have patience for anybody.
Right? The fact that he's not the murderer is what impresses me.
Yeah, we might be onto something here.
Some fan fiction. So, what are your qualifications as a self-proclaimed expert in true crime?
Well, I grew up around crime my whole life. Not the act of doing crime, but yeah, that came across wrong. I grew up, my whole family is in law enforcement, and so crime is just this, like, common language around us all the time. My dad is a retired police officer. My grandfather is passed away, but he is a sheriff. And my brother is a sheriff, so we just have law enforcement running through our blood, and it's just always talked about. And it's like what we talk about when there's nothing else to talk about. So ever since I was a little girl, one of my chores was going through my dad's law books and updating all the laws. And I had to, like, take out just the one page that had been updated of his law book and put in the new page that was the, you know, the updated law. So I got to learn all about the crimes that people might commit and what the what the punishment might be from a very early age. You might even say it helped me learn how to read. So
we had to do that in college. I can't imagine doing that as a kid.
I have this very, you know, very early memories of being, I don't know, let's say 10, looking through my dad's law books, trying to find the pages that had to be replaced, and being like, wow, that's illegal? you know, laws about being naked in public. And, you know, this is just fascinating to me. And then you would have the real life stories that they would just tell around the dinner table, not usually telling the names of the people. So we wouldn't know who they were, but just these stories of their days, of people getting arrested or, you know, anything from A to Z. So it was just always part of our lives growing up. So now as an adult, I just want that, you know, it's like almost like it brings a sense of comfort. I just want that all the time. I want to know from a global perspective down to a very local perspective. I want to hear everything about crime. Just it, like I said, it like brings a sense of comfort to me. And I'm just, it's just part of my daily routine, really.
Why do you think so many people enjoy true crime?
It brings like a sense of excitement. It's not actually happening to you. So there's like a, you know, you can put yourself a little bit away from it. But it's still exciting. It's almost like a TV show. You know, you're watching a drama and you can get that sense of, oh my God, what's going to happen next? But it's not happening to you, so you still have that little bubble to protect yourself.
Yeah, it takes you as close as it can to danger without actually putting you in any danger.
Living
vicariously.
Exactly. So the other thing, too, that I wanted to mention before we even dive into true crime is I think it's important to mention that we're all looking at whatever we talk about today through the lens of women, you know, who have not, to my knowledge, have not gone through the criminal system, you know,
females.
That's very true. So I'll just speak to myself. I'll speak for myself. I have not gone through the criminal system. And I, you know, I'm female, I'm Caucasian. You know, I identify as white, female, and so whatever I say is through that lens. You know, I can't speak for, you know, another side. So it's just purely interest, purely fascination, purely comfort, and sometimes a little humor just to get through it, right? So I just wanted to point out that at least for myself, I like to recognize that we are looking at everything through a specific lens, depending on the person. And for me, I obviously, when I watch true crime, now might be the time to admit that I watch Forensic Files to fall asleep. And when I watch those things, I am obviously looking at it through a lens of being a female Caucasian woman, you know, who has not gone through the criminal system. So everything that I say today is with that perspective and should be taken with a grain of salt. So,
no, right on.
That's completely legitimate, you know.
Commendable for you to bring up, too.
You know, and it's also hard for people sometimes to differentiate between, you know, what you see on television, what you hear on podcasts, stories that you hear, versus what is actually going on. And even then, what is actually going on, there's always three or four sides to the story, mm-hmm. you know? So it is hard to get down to the truth of the matter, you know, because everybody's experiences are different. And so they're dealing with the same factual information is different, how they process.
I think also that people use true crime, you know, get buried in it a little bit, to deal with their own traumas.
Right. As a way to process, perhaps. Or even distract.
Or maybe just acknowledge, you know, maybe that it is out there. not the only people. We are not the only people who are going through this.
Yeah, that's such a good point, Jen. I think seeing it on TV or reading about it for any trauma, is there something about that? There's something about knowing that you're not the only one. And not having to even admit that out loud, but just seeing it and acknowledging it. There's something really healing about that.
Right. You can read a lot of other stories about people who went through what they went through. And people are becoming more open because there's a little bit more anonymity offered on, you know, the internet.
Sure, sure. And just like with regular stories, you can see how a scenario would play out. You know, so if this person comes forward and, you know, talks about what happened with them, and the person who committed the crime is actually goes to jail and is, you know, like if there's a positive outcome for the victim, then that could encourage more people to step forward as well.
Right. And that's a problem. Absolutely. People don't report, you know.
Mm-hmm. Especially people who have been murdered.
It's more difficult for them to report.
It's very true.
I read that on Wikipedia.
Wikipedia is so good for stuff like that.
And I think as we increase true crime is becoming a movement, you know. I've always been interested in it, but I think we can acknowledge as a group that it's really grown in the past couple of years as an interest for people. And I think as it becomes more acceptable to be interested in and be people reporting what is happening to them, I think the laws are also starting to adapt. Even just 5 years ago, 10 years ago, the sentences for people who have been convicted of crimes were just absurd. You know, they were absurd that they were only getting a couple of years for murder or rape. And now, you know, it seems like the justice system is either changing with time or changing with the fact that people are more interested in it and are going to speak out if the sentences aren't going with the crimes appropriately. So that's also, I think, like a really cool thing that's happened with this
right, movement a collective and people energy.
Exactly, yeah.
I do think that they focus, like the true crime genre focuses not solely, but mostly on murder. And I think that's really interesting. There's a lot of different things we don't focus on. You know, we don't have robbery podcasts. I'm sure there are a few.
I've heard of ones where, like, they talk to robbers and, like, hey, we're talking to a robber who got arrested and now is turning around and is going to teach you how to not get robbed. You know, I've heard of those kind of things. But
It just seems like if nobody's getting murdered, then nobody's interested.
It does seem like that's the majority of the focus.
I'm not saying it shouldn't be done. I just think it's interesting that the focus is on murder, you know.
Yeah.
And it's appalling. It is appalling things that we are listening to for various reasons. But why do we, you know, say this is okay and this isn't okay?
And I wonder if it's because we can remove ourselves from it. Again, like I was saying earlier, it's like you still kind of have that distance from murder. And like if I were to see a movie or podcast or series on rape, like you said, you know, it became socially acceptable, I personally probably wouldn't watch it because it would be too hard for me to watch.
Right.
Because for me, it just doesn't feel like there's a barrier there. That third wall isn't there. But for murder, I don't feel like I'm right there. I still feel like it's, you know, there's 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon between me and that person on the ground.
Well, everyone listening has one thing in common, and that's they haven't been murdered. You can't say the same for, you know, rape or sexual assault.
Exactly. Exactly. And I wonder if that's just, I mean, I think you just hit it right on the head. Oh, no pun intended. Woo.
There's the case of Alyssa Turney, who disappeared, and her sister was told that they couldn't do anything and she needed to have the media help. And she did, and she got a podcast, or she established a podcast, and whatever happened, the pressure, who knows, her father was arrested. And my understanding is he's pending trial. So do you have, like, a case that's really stuck with you?
Well, yes. I like the way that you said that, as opposed to, do you have a favorite case?
Do you have a favorite murder?
Yes. And I do. There is one that always gives me the feels. You know, I feel the feels.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the Jonestown case. And I remember when I was quite young, I would say maybe a tween.
Sorry, do you want to just give a quick synopsis for folks who don't know what the Jonestown murders are?
Sure. I said that with a little bit too much enthusiasm. Yes. So, yes, I watched a documentary very late at night, when I was pretty young, and, learned about the Jonestown murders. And essentially that was, about a gentleman named Jim Jones in the 70s who started a cult like following and got them all to move to his own island. And, said that they really would only be saved if they committed suicide. And so he gave them all a special drink. They drank this Kool-Aid-like drink, they say. And they all committed suicide by drinking the drink. And they even gave it, you know, they would drink it themselves. They would give it to their young children. And so many whole families died by thinking that that was their only option to be saved spiritually and physically. And so when the authorities arrived, they just came to this island that had been kind of running itself, like this whole, what they were thinking was a utopian kind of society run by Jim Jones, and just found a slew of just terrible, just dead bodies all over the island, ranging from infants to, you know, older folks who had taken this drink to die to be saved. But really, it was just all his brainwashing of these people.
This is where the term "don't drink the Kool-Aid" came from.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. So don't. Don't drink the Kool-Aid. Don't be brainwashed by someone who's just telling you lies for his own benefit. And so that's really always stuck with me. Anytime information is offered about that case and about that situation, I'm always intrigued to learn more and hear more about. There really isn't many survivors, but when I do hear about survivors telling their stories or families of those survivors, I do tend to be interested to hear it. Because there's also so many different points of views, you know, why did people believe him? What was their mindset? You know, I could go on about this all day, but it's just such an interesting situation. And I don't mean to say that without any sort of insensitivity or sympathy for anyone who has a connection to that case, but it's just incredible.
Cults are very interesting, how they're made and built. I just have this thing, like, everything I hear about Edmund Kemper just makes me more interested in him.
Yeah, Ed Kemper.
Right?
Do you want to tell us about him? I'm not as versed with him as other true crime.
Let's see, this is based on what I remember, but he killed his grandparents, his dad's parents, and He was a kid. He went to the psych unit, and he started writing questions for their tests. Like, he was administering tests to adults when he was, like, under 18. So he's fucking brilliant. This guy's super smart, and he's friendly. Is friendly the right word here?
Charismatic, maybe?
Charismatic, yeah. Maybe mm-hmm. he was friendly, but just not to the people he murdered.
He just didn't come off as a psycho killer.
Right. Well, he would eat lunch with the cops. He wanted to be a police officer. He was too big. He's 6'8", 6'9", huge dude. Just mm-hmm. an enormous man. But the fact yeah. that he's smarter, you know that he's smarter than you. You know, he's smarter than everybody else in the room, and you would never know it. He was finally arrested because he called. He murdered his mom and her friend. He ended up calling the police. He also murdered hitchhikers. So he called because the police weren't doing anything. He says, hey, you know, I killed my mom. And they're like, yeah. So he had to call back. Like, seriously, go check. I did this.
But nobody knew that she was dead, or they knew that she was dead, and nobody...
I don't think they even followed knew that she up was or... dead. They may have figured it out at some point, but... Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think he would have gotten caught if he hadn't turned himself in.
And I think he was also... They named him the co-ed killer, right? Correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because he had this issue with his mom, or he had... He didn't have a great relationship with his mom, so he focused on also murdering female hitchhikers, if I remember correctly.
They may not. Yeah, I think they're hitchhikers, but they could have been students. I know that he used his mom's parking pass for the university to get the women to trust him.
I just recently read a book called Green River Running Red by Anne Rule, and it just highlighted how many murders happen, or serial killers, I should say, happen in California.
Mm-hmm.
Just crazy. Like, I'm sorry, folks in California. What is happening out there?
I think Ohio is tied maybe with, I don't know, somewhere else for most serial killers. Like, we breed them up here.
So we breed them, and then they go to California and kill people.
Guess so.
Is that what you're saying?
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe it's just too cold. Like, the cold just gets to them in Ohio.
Gets in the way of their murdering.
Well, I'm going to Cali.
Well, I mean, but it's so cold outside that people aren't just wandering around. So there's a lot less likely, you know, to just pick up a random person on the street because it's too cold for them to be outside. Which is why all that crazy stuff happens in California.
I was half listening to a podcast this morning, and the guy would just walk up behind women, you know, put them in a chokehold and stab them and then walk away. What the fuck is the point of that? Why would you do that? I mean, why would you stab anybody to begin with? But
sense of power?
I guess.
I think that just goes back to what we were saying before, right? We don't know. The only people that know what and why they're doing this is the person and the victim. Like, we won't ever know.
Well, from the reports, Kemper's mother was a horrible person. I think that was where he was going to go, and I don't understand why people didn't see it. And also, what would he have been if he wasn't a murderer? Like, what could he have done?
Right, what opportunities would he have had? Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, the fascinating thing about all this is the fact that when you finally look at these serial killers, mass murderers, bombers, you know, all these people who do this crazy stuff, they just look like normal people. You know, it's not like they don't look like monsters. They don't look crazy. They don't look, you know, it's like they just look like average dudes, average, you know, people. And, you know, people would have stories about how, you know, Charles Manson used to, you know, walk my dog, or he helped my grandma do dishes or whatever. It's like, yeah, because they're still people. They're still human beings. They've still done stuff, you know. And so it's always hard to say, you know, Jenny brought the question up, was like, how come nobody saw it? How come, you know, it's people generally want to believe the best in the other person, you know, and it's in our nature to give people the benefit of the doubt, or, you know, embrace the weirdo, or, you know, oh, it's a phase, they'll grow out of it, or, you know, oh, his mother was horrible, that's why he acts a little weird. You know, this kind of stuff that we're willing to, I don't know, put ourselves into denial that somebody could actually do something this horrible, as a way to protect ourselves from dealing with the truth. I mean, there's lots of different ways of...
You don't think, like, the guy who's sitting across the booth, you know, or, you know, the booth over, mm-hmm. murdered his, you know, half his family, and I'm not going to go into what else he did, but, you know.
Yeah, you're not gonna think the guy who just, you know, got an extra cup of coffee and is ordering a grilled cheese sandwich.
Who's super, yeah, super friendly.
I like grilled cheese.
Right.
You know, great, now I got something in common with this dude. Awesome.
Grilled cheese brings everybody together. So, Diane, do you think that the new interest in true crime results in a sort of false sense of confidence because of the wall we can put up between us and the awful?
You know, I was actually thinking the opposite, at least for myself, and maybe you can offer an alternative point of view, but at least for me, I think that I often am overconscious of that guy in the booth ordering his grilled cheese. I am constantly aware of what might be, and I think that makes me a very anxious person, so I'm not sure it's necessarily the best. But I'm constantly thinking, lock your doors, lock your windows at night. What's that guy up to over there that's walking his dog? You know, I think true crime has made me a very cautious, hyper-aware person, and has really even removed that wall more for myself. And I have heard people who have been interested in true crime have said, that's given them kind of these, rules for themselves that they follow now where they wouldn't have followed it before, you know, don't walk alone. Like I said, lock your doors, that they might not have done before. So I'd like to think that perhaps has made people more aware and made that wall thinner.
I think that makes sense. I also wonder if people view it as, you know, it always happens to someone else. It's always someone else's problem.
Right. Yes. Yeah, I mean, I don't go walking alone. I'm not going to get in somebody's truck. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to do these things. And you say this stuff, you know, because McGruff the crime dog has taught you at a young age to not do these things.
Right.
You
know, but the thing is sometimes you'll still find yourself in a situation of, or you've done something and afterwards you'll get to go, man, that could have ended horribly.
What the hell's wrong with me?
What was I thinking? You know, and shit happens, you know? I mean, and if the person's charismatic, if they don't seem like a monster, oh, hey, I lost my dog. Can you help me find your dog? Of course I'm going to help you find your dog. Let's find the puppy. Oh, now I'm in a van.
Right.
Great. Cool. Just where I didn't want to be. You know, it's like things happen. It's human nature. But like you said, Diane, hopefully, you know, in hearing these stories and hearing how this stuff, you know, and exposing yourself to this kind of information, hopefully it makes not necessarily more anxiety, induce anxiety, but just induce caution and, you know, not spread knowledge of this stuff.
Right, because people are hearing about things happening right in their own neighborhoods, you know, which maybe before they would have been ignorant to, and not in a bad way, but just... maybe just not being paying attention to, and now they're understanding that things can happen to themselves and their neighbors and their friends, and so they're a little bit more cautious, like like Jen said, you know, oh, it happens to other people and not me. Well, maybe they're seeing now how close it just can get to them.
So are you more interested in hearing stories about serial killers or like one-off?
Ooh, that's a great question. I think serial killers, because I want to know what their motivation was. Yeah, everybody makes mistakes. Not to say that a murder is an okay mistake, but a serial killer, man, that shit's intentional. What's going on there? And I will say though, I really, really hate listening to cold cases, because I want the answer.
Unsolved cases? I was saying that right before we started recording. I was like, I don't want to hear about unsolved cases.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell me who
did it. Some people love it.
Why?
Some people love it.
Maybe that's why I like Ed Kemper, is because he's so willing to talk about why.
Sure.
To give us the information we try to get from everyone else.
Yeah. Those, for me, that's the best kind. It's so odd saying things like that, but yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I really like Mindhunter. Have you seen that on Netflix?
I've only been able to watch the first couple of episodes. One of my favorites on Netflix, though, was The Staircase.
Right?
Yeah, which for those of you who have not seen it, is about an author who resided in Durham, North Carolina, who lived with his wife, and his wife was found murdered at the bottom of a set of stairs. And, well, she was found dead. I'm sorry. Dead. At the bottom of the stairs. And he was at first convicted of murder and said that he pushed his wife down the stairs. But, you know, the case goes on and on and on. Did he murder his wife? Did she fall down the stairs, etc.?
He totally murdered her.
Yeah, well, the other night I was watching Forensic Files, and they had an episode about it that so many more things came to light that were not included in this Netflix special. And I was so interested, and my mother came into the room, because I'm currently staying with my parents over the holidays, and my mom came in. She needed some help with something. And I was so irrationally upset that she interrupted me during this Forensic File episode. I was like, I really want to see this, Mom. Like, I was 15 years old. Mom, I really need to see this. I never got to see the end, but I'm going to go back and find it.
The author is just an unpleasant individual, and that doesn't help his case. Like, I don't know. I think they try, sometimes they try people's personality more than they try them for the actual crime.
Yeah, stuff like that happens all the time. You know, it's like, that's why they tell you when you go to court, you got to wear a suit and, you know, or dress nicely and, you know, smile or don't smile, or, you know, it's like, look remorseful, look like you're sad. Because it is, it's, all of it is psychological.
And I believe that he, Peterson, the one that we're discussing now, I believe that he was the one who made the Netflix documentary so that he could show it from his light, you know, his point of view. He was the one who had it funded, I believe.
The Netflix special was sponsored, funded, written by the accused criminal?
Yeah, I'm looking it up right now because there are a couple. I'm looking up the one.
That would be weird.
Yeah. Yeah. So he paid a French television producer to follow him around. Yeah. I'm reading it as we're talking. But yeah, to follow him around and basically present the case from his point of view. and then it aired on Netflix, you know, years later after the trial. So essentially, it only is going to present the cases from the case from his benefit. And so that's why when I saw the Forensic File episode, I was like, oh my God, there's so much in here that wasn't in the Netflix. There's so much evidence. And for those of you who are not familiar, I'm assuming if you are listening to this true crime episode, you are probably familiar with Forensic Files, but it talks about the forensic evidence that is used to solve a case. And so from the little bit that I caught, thanks, Mom.
Thanks, Mom.
The little bit that I caught, they started talking about blood that was found, you know, on their door frame, their front door frame, that was never mentioned in the Netflix series. And so how would she have fallen down the stairs and then gotten to the front door and, like, had a handprint on her front door, like, if she had died at the bottom of the stairs? Things like that that were never mentioned in the Netflix.
Was it information that helped his case or made him?
No, it would have made him look, either him right. or they talked a little bit. Again, I didn't see the end, so for those of you who are listening and are shouting at me, I don't really know how this ends. But they were also saying that his son could have been involved in this murder based on forensic evidence. And so that was also something that was not mentioned to my recollection in the Netflix series. And of course you wouldn't want your son incriminated in your own series, you know, when you're trying to put the light on it just being an accident. So.
But he paid for that and he still looked guilty. So
I know, right? I mean, he did the best he could, but yeah.
He wasn't coming out of that one ahead.
Yeah, but also, I mean, people are trying to say it was an owl that came in and knocked her over. Like, yeah, a psychotic owl that was also on cocaine, maybe.
Rabbit owl, like, on cocaine.
Yeah.
Those owls on meth, you gotta watch that.
I know, right? That's an epidemic right now.
According to Wikipedia, it is. You know, I want to say something about Wikipedia. Every time I go on there, they ask for a donation of like $2.74. But they have a store you can go to support them. Every single thing is sold out. Like, I'll be happy to give you my money. Give me a scarf. I would rather give you way too much for a scarf than just give you $2.74.
Yeah.
Get it together, Wikipedia.
Yeah, ask PBS. They know how that shit rolls.
Yeah, they do.
Yep. Is there any other, like, major either thing in, like, documentary or case that we should talk about while we're... I don't mean to be the one asking the questions. I did this last time, too. But I just am so interested in this topic.
There was that one guy who... I'm not even going to have a name. I can look it up. But he was married. He had a couple mistresses, and he would constantly go see prostitutes. And he just started murdering prostitutes all over the place, go somewhere else, do the same thing. So there's no idea how many people he really killed. And
are you talking about the Green River Killer?
No. Let me see. He did the same thing.
Yeah, you're not really narrowing it down.
Right. Unfortunately, you're talking about sex workers or indigenous, you know, women.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody cares.
Well, again, with this move, like this true crime movement, fortunately, people are starting to have their stories heard, which is amazing. You know, people are starting to either share their stories or people are sharing it for them. So that's awesome.
I'd have to say that my introduction into true crimes was back in high school when I read In Cold Blood by Truman Capote, and which has been dubbed as the first true crime novel, and where Truman actually, so this murder actually happened in a farmhouse, and the family was very nice, very you know, they're upstanding citizens, they didn't have beef with anybody, all this stuff, and basically two folks came in and killed the entire family in their beds, in their own home. They were looking for money because the farmer had just sold a whole bunch of stuff, and so they thought he was going to have a bunch of cash on him. Turns out he didn't, but they ended up killing the entire family. The farmer, his wife, his daughter, and his son. And Truman Capote went and interviewed interviewed basically the two killers, and over time eventually befriended one of them and learned their whole story, and so was able to piece together from talking to other members of the community, other family members, people who worked with the farmer. But it was his investigation and his being able to personalize that tragic event that actually caught everybody's attention and, like you guys were saying, made it more personable. The fact that this wasn't a big city crime. This wasn't, you know, drug dealers or prostitutes, people who you think that, you know, would find themselves in a situation like this. It was a wholesome family out in the middle of the country, in the middle of nowhere, that were just murdered in cold blood. Did you read that book?
I didn't. And in fact, I'm just looking it up as we're talking, and I was familiar with those crimes and did not realize that that book was a reflection of those crimes. So that's super interesting to me, and now I really would like to read that book.
Yeah.
And also, it seems like I was also aware that there was a movie, but I didn't make the connection between all three. So well, I'm super excited now to read that.
And the cool thing about the book is that it goes into such detail and it lulls you into feeling like that you're that you could be part of this family, or, oh, hey, I'd really like to meet these people sometime. This would be really great. And, you know, and it really gets into the psychology of why the killers did it, because it's more than just facts. It's not like he's an analyzing facts. He went and talked to these people and got their personal emotional reactions to situations and individuals and, you know, the backstories of the killers and, you know, just all of this stuff. Truman, I think, was even there when they finally flipped the switch on the electric chair for one of the convicted killers. But
that's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. But it's a really great book, and it I think was the one that kind of spurred on a lot of investigative reporting into the why people are doing this stuff, as opposed to just, you know, you put a personal face to it, you know, as opposed to just what happened, just the facts, ma'am.
Yeah, that, and your story brings up two very interesting things that I don't want to go down too many paths here, but one is that I also have noticed a movement in making sure that victims' names and stories have been highlighted. As, you know, in news stories, in just profiles, you know, they're downplaying the murderers or the criminals' names, and sometimes often not even mentioning them, but making sure that the victims' names are said and telling more about their personal lives so that we can remember them, which I think that that's just such an awesome thing.
Oh, definitely.
And the other thing I wanted to mention is, I believe it was on Criminal, the podcast that I mentioned earlier by Phoebe Judge, there was one profile on a gentleman who was a warden in a jail, in a prison system, and he talked about his story. He being in charge of putting inmates to death, and that toll that it kind of takes on a person. And often we don't hear their stories, you know, how they have to do a good job. You know, that's part of their job. They have to do that. And so that kind of struggle of him wanting to perform his duties well as being in that role, but also that emotional toll that takes, and how now, I believe he's retired, and he said now he's a huge advocate of obviously getting rid of the death penalty. But it's a really interesting story, and one that I think we don't often think of is the person who actually goes in and performs that that act of the death penalty. So,
and how they deal with that.
Yeah. Yeah, and what do we as a society give them as resources to support them emotionally, physically, you know, that deal with that on a semi-regular basis?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, even in firing, like when firing squad, you know, they have, 10 people lined up with a rifle aimed at somebody, but only one person actually has a bullet, you know? So it's like, so then it takes the psychological, you know, responsibility off of them of actually
knowing
ending a life. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have a lot of weird theater stuff that needs a new home, and you prefer it doesn't just go into the dumpster? Reset likes the weird stuff. With ResetYourSet.com, you can find listings to buy, sell, and rent items that folks in the industry will truly appreciate. Go find them on Instagram, Facebook, at ResetYourSet, and check out the site that offers so much more. ResetYourSet.com.
Have you guys, I don't know why I didn't mention this before when we were talking about cold cases, but have you heard all about how the Golden State Killer came to be solved? I think it was last year, and Michelle McNamara's book, she wrote I'll Be Gone in the Dark. She, you know, again, it was that bringing everything to light led to more investigations, and they actually caught the Golden State Killer from the 70s.
It was big news, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Again, like, just that support and just really great journalism. Just
familial DNA.
Yep, familial DNA. Real great stuff happening.
Yep.
As Anna said.
So, do you prefer, like, crime TV, podcasts, books, or all three?
I prefer anything I can get my hands on. I listen to podcasts a lot, and I'm very honored to be here with you today. But I watch TV at night before I go to bed, which leads to some very weird dreams, I must admit. Some really weird dreams. But I also, have read some really great books. Like I just mentioned, I finished Anne Rule's Green River Running Red, which is about the Green River Killer.
And you want to low down on Green River because you just read it? This is nuts.
Yeah, the Green River Killer, he was mostly in the Seattle area. Seattle area. In the 70s again, 70s, 80s. And he just would pick up female hitchhikers and sex workers and murder them and dump their bodies. And they just could not catch him. He just, I mean, just countless women. I mean, it, but he would often dump their bodies in the Green River, which is why he was dubbed that. And Anne Rule was the same journalist who worked with Ted Bundy She worked on this case with the policeman, and so she wrote a novel about her journey. And it's just a very interesting book. I'm not going to give away the end. Very factual. It talks again about the victims. It really focuses on each of the victims, even provides pictures of them, and talks about their families. So with that, we can really remember the journeys of the victims and what they went through, as much as we know really their backgrounds, and less about the killer. And she talks about how the killer tried to profile him to determine who he was.
Yeah, I think they knew who he was for a while, but they just couldn't get it. I could be wrong.
Well, I mean, perhaps the book is a little dated. And I don't want to give it away in case somebody wants to read it.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
But yeah, they definitely did a lot of profiling and had suspects. And they had lots of teams on the case over time. And the other, again, we've chatted a little bit about this in this episode. It was, unfortunately, a lot of his victims were sex workers in the 70s and 80s. And so oftentimes if they were survivors, their testimony was not necessarily considered credible. So unfortunate. But eventually people started taking them seriously, and you know, we got them.
It's unfortunate it takes so long.
Yeah, and that's a trend, right, that we see in these true crime stories of murderers or really criminals, sex offenders in general. Is I was just listening to one of the episodes on My Favorite Murder where they talked about these crimes that were happening in California, and forgive me, I don't remember which criminal it was, but he was raping and murdering sex workers in the 80s in California, and they were black sex workers, and they were actually written down as what did they call it? They weren't considered human beings in the report.
Yeah.
They were just considered, you know, objects. So not only were their testimonies not considered real or credible, it wasn't even considered a crime against a human being.
You just got to let that sink in.
I mean, it's also... It's a much different time, a much different place. Not saying that any of that stuff is cool, but, you know, considering women weren't allowed to get bank accounts and on their own until 1970, 1975. So, women being unto themselves, single, let alone a sex worker, you know, was already taboo, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and like you said, Anna, you know, we're coming into this now with so many positive things have come out of where we are as a society now and as a movement, true crime movement. And also, I think that training and education for law enforcement and society has improved, so.
Sure. Sharing other people's stories, we're able to put ourselves in other people's shoes a lot easier than it has been in the past.
Yeah, and we learn from history, right? Like Jen said earlier, like, don't drink the Kool-Aid. We know that now.
Well, we have one final question we ask everybody, and that is, what is your guilty pleasure? I feel like it might be true crime, but take it away.
I think that's definitely one of them. We touched on another one when I visited briefly in another episode, which is cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely cheese and fried versions of cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And dogs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm giving a lot away here, but yeah. So, I mean, essentially, if I'm sitting in front of a TV watching Forensic Files and I've got my dog next to me and a plate of cheese, I'm a happy girl.
I don't think there's anything better than that.
So all you single men out there looking for a girl who likes cheese and Forensic Files with no room in her bed for someone because her dog's taking up the whole bed. Look no further.
He just has to get you a king-size bed.
Yeah. Well, I have one and the dog takes up the whole bed. So all you dog owners know what I'm talking about.
Yep. Well, I know I definitely appreciate you coming on and talking to us about true crime.
Oh, I had so much fun.
Yeah, I learned a bunch of stuff, and it's always good talking to you.
Yeah, you too. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on. What I had heard was we are out of time. I'll see you next week.
See you soon.
Visit our website at WIHHW.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, see guest links and information, and some fancy extras. Also, check us out on Facebook at What I Had Heard Was, and Instagram at What I Had Heard. And if you really want to get something off your chest, shoot us an email at whatihadheardwas@gmail.com.